WFSU FM now presents a delayed broadcast of the January 14th, 2014 public forum of the Village Square. This program was recorded at St. John's Episcopal Church in Tallahassee.
I'm Liz Joyner, the executive director of the Village Square. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you to Fears, where not everybody shares your pain. Tonight's program is the second in this year's Dinner at the Square series, Join the Asteroids Club, a project with NYU's Dr. Jonathan Haidt, creating a new approach to communicating about the civic problems that polarize and paralyze us. To say a word about the Asteroids Club, I'd like to introduce Village Square Board member Bill Maddox.
Welcome, everyone. I'm glad to see you all here again. My job this evening is to just set a little context for the discussion that you're about to hear, which is really a first for us, a unique setting, as you can see here, and we'll be describing that in just a minute. The Asteroid Club is an idea that came from John Haidt, as Liz mentioned, and the basic idea is this, is that if you talk to people on the left or talk to people on the right, you will soon discover that there are certain asteroids that they believe threaten our future, that are screaming towards us that we need to do something about. Now, typically at this time, if you were here last time, you'll recall that Steve Siebert stood up and did a very thorough and important discussion of graphs that looked a lot like these, dealing with our topic last time, which was income inequality and the decline of the family. This week, or this time, our discussion is all going to be about entitlement reform and the growing debt that our nation faces, as well as the issue of climate change. And the basic graph from last time works for these problems as well. If you want to talk with someone on the left about climate change, they'll tell you this is what we have in the past, this is where we are now, this is where we're going in the future. It's very scary, it's very threatening. The same, of course, happens when you have a discussion on the right about entitlement reform. And the idea behind the whole Asteroids Club that John Haidt had was, let's get people on the left and the right together, and they can compare notes and share with each other the asteroid that they think threatens our future. And hopefully out of that will come greater mutual understanding. Well, this is, I think, a great concept and one that I'm glad to participate in. But it seemed a little bit, when Liz first explained this to me, it seemed a little bit like marriage counseling, where you go and you listen to what the other spouse says, and then you try to explain your point of view, and hopefully you come with some understanding. So we determined that tonight what we really need are two things on the table that will help facilitate our conversation. One is a recognition that whatever differences may separate us as liberals or conservatives, that there are some things that we have in common. And one thing that we have in common, though we may not wish to admit it, is a shared concern about sustainability. We have with us tonight a gentleman who was sitting here at my table, David Blankenhorn, a longtime friend of mine, New York City guy, who has recently joined our national board for the Village Square, does this kind of talk, this kind of work all the time. David reintroduced to me several years ago this concept of thrift, which I think is useful for us in this discussion. Thrift is all about helping young people develop a sense of self-reliance so that they will no longer be dependents. This is what we all hope for our kids, right? Is that they'll grow up and be self-reliant individuals who will show self-control when it comes to using their resources. They won't squander things that they've been given or that they earned, and that hopefully they will have a sense of the importance of giving back and making sacrifices so that they can one day invest in children of their own and can one day support aged parents, perhaps, who may need their help. Well, it's not surprising to me that this thrift cycle has that same picture that we so often associate with environmentalism, because we all know that in many ways what we're talking about tonight is really about sustainability for the future. How do we create a future in which our children and our children's children can enjoy what we have and can flourish? So sustainability is a common denominator. There are differences, obviously, between how we see these different topics. And to help us get to the bottom of some of those differences, we asked Neil Skeen, Many of you know Neil as the former editor of the St. Pete Times. But we asked Neil to come and to do something that he hasn't done in a long time, which is to tend bar here at our Fears bar. And he's going to invite some good friends up, and they're going to have a conversation. And we think that in addition to recognizing our common concern about sustainability, hopefully after a few drinks, there will be that we'll have an opportunity to have a little social lubricant that will help facilitate a conversation that might actually lead us to a place where we better understand one another and can understand each other's concern. So without further ado, I turn it over to my favorite bartender, Mr. Neil Skeen.
Who forgot to ask how to work the microphone. Well, thank you, and welcome to Fears. You've heard the story about how this came about. One of the things that Village Square stands for is focusing on facts and not perceptions and made-up things. But tonight, you'll have to use your imagination because we didn't have a bar available for our use, and we thought we would use a church instead. But it's okay, they're Episcopal. If you see the communion serving pieces, though, just think of them as shot glasses. All right, so I'm the bartender for the evening. Some of you know that I once had a career in journalism, but the way things are going in journalism these days, I thought I would try this. They're a lot alike, really. You just sort of throw a few things together in a glass and hope it comes out okay. But you can call me Coach. There is one thing I want to do. This is my bar, and I get now for the next hour. And so I get to do what I want to. But some of you also know that for about 10 years, I have coached the undergraduate mock trial team at Florida State University. And I will tell you that being a lawyer and a bartender is really helpful in teaching at Florida State University. Did anybody see the Onion piece about how they're actually going to phase out the academic program and just concentrate on football? But not everybody knows. I mean, everybody knows that Florida State just won the national championship in football, right? We know that. That was good. What everybody doesn't know is that in April, Florida State University and the mock trial team, of which I'm the coach, also won the national championship against 552 teams. But no small part of that success was due to a guy who came in last January after I'd coached this team for 10 years and never made it to the national tournament. He's a wonderful lawyer. He's a former law school mock trial champion. And today is his birthday. His wife, Gwen Graham, said that, remember that name, said that she asked him how he wanted to celebrate his birthday and he wanted to come to Village Square. And so I want you all to give a happy birthday to Steve Herm, who is right over here. Okay, so we have this bar called Fears, and Bill sort of told you this idea, sort of that, you know, everybody has their fears. Half the people agree with it that it's fearful. Half the people really just couldn't care less whether it exists and the problem that entails in terms of actually accomplishing anything to do about it. So a few years ago, after the coal plant debate in our town, a friend of ours named Brian Armstrong ran for city commission against a commissioner who had supported the coal plant. And we started meeting on Wednesday nights as sort of, this was important, campaign strategy planning. But it happened to be over beers. So, and one of the people who came to those beer nights, besides me, was Ed Moore, who is more conservative than Brian and I might be. But we had great conversations about politics. And so as we were planning this program, we decided we would sort of replicate that event. And again, using your imagination and thinking of this as a particularly high-ceilinged bar. So for people who are more conservative, one of the great concerns in our society is the national debt and the role of entitlement spending in the creation of that national debt. For people who are more liberal, perhaps the greatest concern about our children's future is the effects of global warming. Neither side can really get the other to engage in any real problem solving about that. So tonight we thought we would replicate those old discussions from Brian's campaign and just have an informal discussion about all things. I assure you that we have spent far more time on the props and staging than we have on the content. In fact, I spent most of today gathering up the liquor and just a few minutes putting my notes together. I want to welcome them here one at a time. They'll come up here to the bar. And I know there's little biographies about them in the program, or at least I think there might be. So I'm not going to repeat all of that. I want to tell you a few things you don't know about them. The first one is Ed Moore. Now, you can read in the program his role in higher education. And he aspires, but besides controlling higher education among the private colleges and universities in the state, he aspires to be like his own great-grandfather, Archibald Kirkland Mason, shown here in 1835. Ed is a grandfather. One day, inevitably, he too will be a great-grandfather. But Ed is also... And I think you'll see, if you look at the next picture... You will see the future for this man in Archibald Kirkland Mason. Ed is also a licensed soccer coach in two states. Personally, you know, as a liberal person, I think it is just a sign of how overregulated we are that you have to be licensed as a soccer coach. He was a soccer referee in two states, probably because he got ran out of the first one. He's also a certified swimming referee in two states. I don't know which two states, but it's probably not the one he's in. He also likes to hunt. And if you're squeamish, have we got this picture? If you're squeamish, don't look at this picture. But you really don't want to ever suggest that Ed is a boar. But let's all say hi, Ed, to Ed Moore. Yeah, we'll leave that one up so everybody can keep looking at it. It'll be good. Have a seat, Ed. You want to come over to the bar? Come over to the bar. Yeah. So what's going down, Ed?
Need a mic?
Yeah.
We're on. What'd you say? I'm sorry?
I said, what's going down?
My blood alcohol level. Pour me one.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Ed, they... basically, I know you've been concerned about the national deficit for a long time. What are you thinking about that these days?
It's a depressing day. You need to change the name of the bar to Tears ought to be the
Tears.
Name of the bar.
Tears. So we'll do that. So,
very
yeah.
depressing day. Besides...
You want to just pour it in there, right?
Besides Justin Bieber's house getting raided this morning, the national debt is the next serious crisis in America. We got problems. In River City.
Brand River City.
Big problems. You know me, I do a lot of reading, I do a lot of thinking, and you look at the size of the national debt, you look at the entitlement programs and the role they play. We're on an unchartable course. We're on a course that just can't be sustained. And as you talked about being a grandfather and a great-grandfather, we're leaving a burden to people that had nothing whatsoever to do with creating that situation, and it's up to us to solve it.
Well, there you go.
Thank you.
Cheers. Fears. Well, it's about time we get Brian here. Now, Brian's a lawyer.
Where's that liberal guy?
Where is he? He handles a lot of water and electric utility cases. And the thing about Brian
he feeds them, I shoot them. So.
Yeah, Ed eats the animals, and the animals eat Brian. That's kind of the what seems to be going on here. But and then after he gets eaten, he will also, as you will see, feed them. But Brian was born in Queens, actually, so that explains a lot. He moved to Orlando and then moved to Tallahassee in 2000. And we'll leave that one up right next to Grandpa Archibald, I think. Yeah.
Did he say, hey, Brian, what day is it? Huh? Oh, what day?
Well, you know, Brian has a beer bottle collection. And the only requirement to get into the beer bottle collection is that Brian has to drink the beer himself. So that's it. So let's all say hi, Brian. So
pull
that's
a table over. Pull a table over, yeah.
So Brian, how's it going?
Poor.
Poor. I'm really sorry to hear that.
No. Poor.
Oh, poor. I got it.
Did a rim shot or something. Yeah.
So, you know, the first thing I thought I'd do, Ed, is, and Brian both, I mean, tell me about how you two sort of people on opposite ends of the spectrum kind of got to be friends.
Quotas. It's a quota thing. I have to have so many liberal or conservative friends, so it works out this way.
Yeah. You know how boring life would be if every friend you had, you agreed about everything with? Well, Ed and I are great friends. We don't agree about very much.
Other than FSU football.
And we encourage everybody. Actually, when I hold this to my hand and I think about the bar we're in Fears, I'm thinking about often that many of us have kids. And I remember my children, and especially when they got to be younger teenagers, we go to a bar and they often said, I talk too loud. And the whole bar can hear you. Well, I want to make sure everybody understands that tonight we want the whole bar to hear me, and we want you to participate. So if you have something to say, make a squirrely face or raise your hand and let's get you involved in this conversation because we really want to have a discussion with you all and have you participate. And you heard about fact-checking. Did everybody hear about fact-checking? Well, if you have a fact you want checked or you want to raise your hand and say something that's incorrect, let us know because I'll tell you about the first fact-check of the night. If you open your program, you'll open and you'll see on about the third or fourth page it says City Commissioner Brian Armstrong. It didn't happen.
Use your imagination.
Yes, exactly. And as we've talked about, and we really did talk about this during the campaign, even though Brian DeLoge and others were actually on the other side of the fence from me when we got involved talking about climate change back during that election. If you remember, Tallahassee was considering building a plant together with Jacksonville Electric Authority.
Hold on. Can everybody hear Brian well? Or does he need to? Okay,
I'll
good.
Bring it right
this,
up.
This is a
I
bar full of deaf people.
Okay. But we're here tonight. I'm here to talk about human-driven climate change, and it's something that Ed and I are totally just different ends of the spectrum on. And it's really a concern for me because just like back then and what I saw going on, what I thought was going on back then, I think is happening now. But if we look at the facts, in 2004, there were 1,000 scientific studies that were analyzed, and they were by scientists. And it was the question ultimately was, look at these scientific studies, and are they saying that there is climate change, and are they saying there's human-driven climate change? 75% of those studies said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. 25% of the studies either said, we don't have an opinion, or we don't believe, we're skeptical about it. In 2009, another study occurred with another 1,000 scientific studies that were reviewed, and the number, 97% of scientists believe there's human-driven climate change. Just recently, we had a study that involved the review of 12,000 scientific papers. 97% of the papers that dealt with climate change. Out of that 12,000, 4,000 dealt with climate change. 97% said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. Now, if you go a step further and you look behind those papers, because we probably know a lot of those are co-authored. There's more than one author. They're peer-reviewed, and people sign on. If you go the next step, it's not 97%. It's 98.4% of 10,000 scientists that said, yes, there is human-driven climate change. That's pretty incredible. Now let's think, 98.4, take that from 100, that's 1.6%. That 1.6 doesn't say no, we're skeptical, there isn't. Many of them just have no opinion. And others have said they're skeptical about whether it's climate change. Think about those facts. And then think about this. Just recently, in September, a poll was done. The results came out recently where they polled all of us. And they went to the public and they said, do you believe there is climate change? And do you know the number for 2013 is 63% of the people polled said we believe there's climate change? And a more startling fact to me is that when the next question was asked, do you believe that humans are contributing to climate change, it was only 49% of the people. 49% of the people, given the facts that we just talked about, 10,000 scientists who did studies, 98.4% have said there is human-driven climate change, but yet the public believes 49, only 49% of that believes that, 51% don't even think humans are contributing to climate change. And, you know, tonight, I guess that's one of the things we want to talk a little bit about. And as you can see, look at my man here, getting a little bit antsy. But we really want discussion among all of us about that.
No, I'm just happy that science isn't run as a democracy. Scientific change, anybody that studied scientific theory or the theory of science knows that progress comes from those outliers, the people that disagree and disprove what science believes. There are no facts in science. It's just changing reality, and I'm more in that group. If science never changed, I bet if we went back in time, 100% of medical doctors thought leeches were what you needed to cure you. Progress comes from those who challenge the accepted norm, and that, you know, you said it's fact. I don't believe it's fact. It's debatable. We'll move forward. All sides agree that we ought to do something about the environment. All sides agree that population is an issue. There's, you know, soon, by 2050, we'll probably have 9 million people on this planet. To me, a more critical issue than what the temperature is will be how are we going to feed and provide water resources for all of those people. The resources of the country ought to be focused on those kinds of issues more than let's wait and see and what scientists think now. There's 14, you can go, you Google climate change and you'll find 14 different positions in the first 14 listings that come up. So we probably at some point ought to bring up some experts rather than us too opinionated.
Before we do that, though, let me say this. And I agree, there are people who have adverse opinions. Less than 1.6% of the scientists that we know of have adverse opinions. And this is one thing that Ed and I have spoken about. There are only a few of the high-focused people who have denied climate change. There's a fellow I'll talk a little bit about later who wrote a book in 2001. And said it's a hoax, you know, it's a farce. We waste all our money on that, and so there are some deniers out there. But what is amazing to me over the last 10 years, and certainly the last 6 years, is that, you know, a lot of the high focused deniers, original deniers, or skeptical scientists have now flipped. They've now turned around, and a couple of the most cited and quoted, the deniers, the skeptics who are put on TV and the radio, they have come out. One of them did a study funded by one of the Koch brothers, and he was the preeminent skeptical human-driven climate change scientist.
They changed their position?
And he did. He changed his position. So do you know what he said?
They can come and run for governor in Florida then, I guess.
Do you know what he said? And Ed and Neil know everywhere I go. Doesn't everybody bring a crib sheet when they go to a bar? They take it out and everything? I do that all the time, everywhere, every bar I go to. But here's the quote when this fellow went back. And what he did was he went and he looked at all the, he analyzed all the studies that were done. The things that he doubted, and he said, I have reasons to doubt, he went and he looked at it himself with 12 other scientists. And here's the opening of his New York Times op-ed when he flipped and said, I'm no longer a denier. He said, call me a converted skeptic. 3 years ago, I identified problems in previous climate studies that, in my mind, threw doubt on the very existence of global warming. Last year, following an intensive research effort involving a dozen scientists, I concluded that global warming was real and that prior estimates of the rate of warming were correct. I'm going to take a step further. Humans are almost entirely the cause.
Hey, Coach, does he get a 10-point penalty for bringing AIDS to the
tournament? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's probably it. But I'll tell you what, you know, I think that this just proves what I always say. Every bar needs an economist. Think about that. And so, I know Ed, you've got an economist friend that you're going to bring along here. I don't know if that's like an aide or not, but I know that economics has been called the dismal science. Now, I know a lot of other science, and it sounds pretty dismal, too, including some of the stuff Brian just talked about. But we invited each of our two friends tonight to bring a wingman. Brian brought a wingwoman. But tonight, Randy Holcomb, who's an economics professor at Florida State, he writes economic analysis for the James Madison Institute. Randy and I were once, this is Randy, he's not the guy in the tie. Even though he looks like the economist, the guy in the tie is an Iranian. Randy says he wore the tie the whole time, I guess so he could sort of look like an economist. But Randy and I were on a panel one time, and I was the guy who was there supposed to talk about tax increases, and it was at James Madison, and nobody else in the room believed in tax increases. And I remarked that here I was talking about taxes and tax increases in a room of people who don't believe in gun control. So Randy, I think, was the only one who laughed. But Randy's the only one who laughs. So we want to show you some other pictures of Randy. But he's here. As you can see, now he's in full dress uniform as an economist. He's gone over to the Soviet country called Georgia, not the one just up the road, to teach them that central planning is not the best way to go into the future, and I guess they probably already have realized that. But he went over there to teach, and so this is Randy showing his equestrian skills. We'll show you some more pictures of Randy. He's a photographer, but he hasn't quite mastered the concept of the selfie yet. But we'll bring him up here anyway, Randy Holcomb. So.
No, I think that's the same tie. Gosh, it's a little early, isn't it? Script.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you, you wanted a drink. It's a little early for a drink?
No, not so too early for a drink, too early for stupid questions.
Oh, yeah, it is kind of early for stupid questions.
That's all on my script. I don't know what else I'm supposed to say.
Yeah, no, that's his total script for the evening. This feels like the Jackie Gleason show, vaguely. We'll have Crazy Guggenheim coming up here in a minute. So, Randy, you've listened to this little discussion about from these guys. What do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree with Ed about some of the looming problems with regard to entitlement programs. And I think the facts are well enough known. I don't think it's controversial that we're spending more and more on these entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are the big ones. We have other means-tested entitlement programs. And they're driving the budget deficit, and those problems are going to get worse. Part of it is, well, you look at the name, entitlement program. People think they're entitled to their government check. When you look at Social Security, the fastest growing part of Social Security is disability benefits. These are people under age 62 who don't qualify for old age benefits, but even though it seems like we have a healthier population, more and more people are getting disability benefits. That's one of the things driving Social Security. On the healthcare side, it's even worse, and we have demographics working against us on Medicare and Social Security. Population is living longer. There are more older people, fewer young people who are paying the taxes to support them. So these are problems. And ultimately, another problem is the interest on the debt. Right now, the interest on the federal debt's below 5% of federal government spending. But you know interest rates are very low. It would be easy to imagine when you think about interest rates today that they could triple because they've been three times as high or more in the past. And if that happens, interest spending will rise to about 15% of federal government spending. That's another 10% of federal government spending that's not going to these other programs. And in that case, what are we going to cut the other programs? We haven't in the past. We have these interest groups who lobby to keep their entitlements. When Social Security was started, the elderly in the United States tended to be pretty poor. Today, they're wealthier than average. And yet, the AARP is a pretty strong lobby to keep those benefits flowing. And what the heck? Because when the problem really arises, they'll be dead. You know, it's somebody else's problem. So the theme here, we're talking about asteroids. So is this really an asteroid? It's a little bit different from the climate change issue, because if you're thinking about climate change and you're thinking this is something that's going to happen unless we do something about it. But the debt issue, that's different. When we look at the growth in expenditures, you look at what we've promised people, there's no way we can pay off what we've promised people. So this idea about, you know, entitlements growing to 50% of GDP, and eventually the government budget being 100% of GDP, you know that can't happen, right? And if it can't happen, it won't happen. So what's going to bring an end to it? And one of the problems that we have is there are all these interest groups who are lobbying to keep the benefits, and it's possible this thing just keeps going until we end up having a crisis. So how is it going to end? One scenario, look at the Roman Empire. A lot of what we see in the United States has a parallel in what we saw in Rome. They had increasing entitlement programs. They gave free bread to poor people, eventually free bread to everybody. Bread in circuses, providing these welfare programs and entertainment. And as they did, a lot of it they financed by debasing the currency. Started with Emperor Nehru. They had gold-based currency backed by precious metals. And over time, they gradually lowered the precious metal content of the currency so that over a period of about 250 years, from 50 AD to about 300 AD, the value of the Roman currency fell to only 5% of what it was 250 years before. So as incredible as that sounds, when the Federal Reserve was established in 1913... You look at the century since the Federal Reserve was established, our currency, our dollar, has fallen in value by more than that. What you can buy with a dollar today, you could have bought with a nickel in 1913. So we're already seeing some of that. So what's going to happen? What's this asteroid going to happen? Well, I mean, part of it could just be a gradual decline like the Roman Empire. On the other hand, look what happened when people were dissatisfied behind the Iron Curtain in East Germany and the other Iron Curtain countries. And there was a sudden upheaval, a sudden change. That's the potential for the asteroid. Now, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but a lot of times nobody predicted, in the mid-80s, nobody predicted that. Sometimes social change happens very rapidly.
You know, Neil, if I could,
yeah, go ahead.
And Randy, we've spoken about this, and we do agree to a significant extent there are some mathematical equations here, and we can make some mathematical changes. But, you know, as I've mentioned, Ed and I have talked about it a little bit. Is the solution, and what I am most concerned about is the solution, is to actually take what we may call entitlements away from the people who, in a large part, are the least able to afford to have them taken away. And is that going to make us better or worse off? What happens to those people? But it's very funny you bring up the Roman Empire, because I know, Ed, we've talked about this a bunch too. The Roman Empire. I see the Roman Empire, and they say income inequality killed the Roman Empire.
Nuts.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I see the French Empire, and I see income inequality and let them eat cake, and that attitude killed a lot of people. Lost their heads because of that. They let that go too far. And isn't that something too that needs to be addressed together with? Isn't it all part of that same mathematical equation?
Well, a lot of the benefits, a lot of these entitlement programs, they're benefits that are going to people who don't need it, people who are not poor and who are not struggling. You know, a lot of that's for the Social Security. A lot of Social Security payments are like that. But the real problem, if you look at entitlement spending, is in the health care, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare. That's where a lot of the problem is. And my view is the problem is that because of our government policies, healthcare is not market driven. There are no market checks. Nobody pays for their own health care. You know, if we had auto insurance the same way that we have health insurance, you know, our auto insurance would pay for our gasoline and pay for our tires and so forth. You know, insurance should be for unexpected events. And we need to have more of a market in healthcare. Right now, it pays the companies that provide healthcare to provide the most expensive care possible because they get reimbursed. But if there was a market and people shopped around for their healthcare, then people would be competing based on price.
But what about that? You mentioned that a lot of the entitlements are going to people who don't need them or fraudulently use them or whatever. I mean, has that been quantified? I mean, that's something I'd like. I look at these scientific studies about human-driven climate change, and I know that's been quantified, analyzed to the T. Are there places where I can go? Because I looked after we spoke the first time, and I don't see any place where that's been quantified about how much is actually fraudulent or going to people who don't need it. That's certainly not what I hear or believe at this point, but I'd be willing to take a look if you can point to those.
Well, and I wish I had some good figures to tell you right now, but I didn't bring my notes. Like,
trip sheet.
Like,
you should go to bars with me more often. You know, I have a trip sheet every time I go to a bar.
And of course,
got a few.
But it's hard to uncover fraud. I mean, you want figures on fraudulent activity, but it's hard to uncover because people keep it secret.
You know, okay. Right, I want to get one more person in here. I want to get somebody to help Brian out on the climate change side. All I have to do is find my notes. And being total contrarians, we have saved the woman for last. I know, I'm not even going to do jokes about that. Especially with all you drunks looking to get a fight. Okay, what I'd like to say about Susan Glickman is that, first of all, this was her Christmas tree. This is it.
I brought my Christmas tree.
This is the Crown Royal Christmas tree. On the other hand, I do want to tell you that she attended an all-girl Catholic school starting in the seventh grade at the Academy of Holy Names. I don't think Crown Royal was one of them.
That's where I learned to drink.
That's where you learned to drink. She decided to attend the University of Texas. Great school. Why? Because Austin has great music. In Austin. And you might not suspect this, but she was also a tutor for the athletic department. She told me that she saw the Tampa Bay Bucks win the Super Bowl in 2003. She saw the Tampa Bay Lightning win the Stanley Cup in 2004.
That's right.
But I know that you did not see the Florida State mock trial team win the national championship in 2013.
And I would have been riveted.
You would have been riveted.
It
was riveting.
There, yes.
She's also got a sideline right now. She is working with a partner who is here.
Yes, my friend Noel Thomas. Right there.
To commercialize software to track human traffickers.
That's right. That's what we do for fun.
This is what she does for fun. So anyway, here's Susan Glickman.
Great. So,
Susan,
I've had a very tough day in the Capitol, and you promised me a drink.
So you want a drink?
So I can get back there and pour a little drink if you want.
So you can do that. So,
but you got to limit me to one. Or
to one?
Make that 1:30.
1:30. Okay, it's good. I'll cut you off at 1:30.
So anyway.
All yours.
I think it's probably appropriate that I'm going to make a drink while we're talking about global climate change. So I've done public interest work my whole life, and I think some of it did have... comes from those values that you learn going to parochial schools. I went to Episcopal school and Catholic school. I read the Old Testament, the Holy Communion service in fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. So when I have spent my whole life doing public interest work, and I've done tobacco policy and work on women's reproductive health issues, and I got into the public health issues, which brought me to energy and climate about 14 years ago. So on that note, we are going to have a drink because... there's some pretty serious issues. So I appreciate everybody's... Yeah, that would be really awesome. Very good. So this is the Crown Princess, and that was a picture of me at the Bucks game. And as people walked down the side of the parking lot, I would say that we were doing pro bono work for Crown Royal this holiday season, and we hoped they would support Crown Royal. It was a very good cause. So anyway, people, no one knew what to do with that, so... I'm going to come join.
Okay,
I met Brian Armstrong because I got involved in fighting that coal-fired power plant in 2007. Do you want me right over here, or am I going to block you?
Yeah, pick yourself any chair you want.
Okay, great. Anyway, I was part of a number of people fighting about 7 coal-fired power plant proposals, and coal-fired power plants are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions, and we have a problem. So a lot of people say to me, you know, I don't believe in global warming. And I said, believe in global warming. What you believe in is you believe in the virgin birth or you don't. That's a tenet of faith. Global warming fundamentally is parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. It's a measurement. And like your height and your weight, it just is. So this arguing about whether you believe in that or you don't is just really not valid. Now, I'm not a scientist. I'm a very practical person. And as I said, I've done tobacco policy. I'm a political person. And frankly, this is a political issue. But when I look at a scientific issue, I look at people, and I'm very much hoping that my friend Pam McVitie, who is a biologist with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, comes by tonight because she may want to add a few facts. But nonetheless, when I look at the National Academy of Sciences and the American Geophysical Union and the American Chemical Society and some 18 prominent U.S. scientific organizations and almost 200 internationally that agree, and Brian, you made some really great points, and the fact is there's not one single peer-reviewed scientific publication that flies in the fundamental face of the basic premise that greenhouse gas emissions are building up and it's warming the planet and it is human activity with the first British Industrial Revolution and then the American Industrial Revolution that has added these greenhouse gas emissions, and it's not a good thing. Now, given that we already said I work on global warming and human trafficking, my friend Noel and I call ourselves the buzzkill team. We can really put a poll on a party. But let me tell you, the good news is that we have solutions. And those solutions are the things that are going to give that next generation. And this is how we're going to solve the entitlement problem, because we're going to create a clean energy economy that are actually going to create some real jobs in this country. And we can insulate and put in new windows and be more efficient. And you know what, Randy? I loved what you said earlier about the competition for insurance, and that fundamentally our healthcare system rewards the most expensive insurance. Well, that's what we do in the state of Florida. 75% of our state is represented by investor-owned utilities. And they're like waiters in a restaurant that had a guaranteed tip on their account. Their job is to sell the extra bottle of wine and the dessert, because they make more money the more they spend.
Want another drink?
Yeah, well, I haven't even started this. So that's, with that, I'll hand it back to you. But we have a fundamental restructuring of utility regulation.
Need to change the name of the bar to Fantasyland here.
Fantasyland. Okay, that's good. Well, we have a lot of bar names. Maybe I should start writing them on the board here. So let me just ask a question. So how much of this, you know, that guy Bill who was here earlier, he's gone now, right? He sort of showed that chart, you know, past, present, and futures, kind of like the ghost of Christmas past, present, future. And so the line's going up, it starts going up, and I thought he was going to climb up a ladder, you know, and show us the very tip top of that, like Al Gore did. But that's the line that both of you talked about. I mean, we've talked about it for entitlements. The line sort of goes, and, you know, as the baby boomers get older, as the number of people who are producing earned income and FICA withholding and Medicare withholding gets smaller, that gets to be more of a problem. You, Susan, and Brian have talked about parts per million and the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and what it does to the Earth's temperature. And that number starts going up, and the more it gets, it's kind of like the boiling water. You know, I mean, everything in it starts to get really hot really fast, and it goes up really fast. So to what extent do we think that each other's hockey stick chart is real? Or is it, in fact, is the problem with the numbers, the scope of the problem to begin with, or is it what we do about it, if anything? So, Ed, you were going to say
I'll go first on that one. I think of the two issues, the most solvable and most critical, immediately critical one, is the issue of spending. If you want to solve all of these problems, address any kind of environmental concern, you don't have the money to do it based on current federal budget. How do we get here? In my view, and I guess this is where liberals and conservatives have a big divide. Back in 1964, when President Johnson announced the war on poverty, his intent then was to eradicate poverty, to do away with it, to remove poverty from the United States. Instead, what we've done is built up a total of 80 federal programs that are means-tested programs, none of which ever go away, none of which ever are evaluated for effectiveness, and they continue to be fed. As they are fed, they grow. Randy mentioned on the federal budget size, right? Right now, entitlement spending is about three-quarters of the federal budget. A quarter of the federal budget goes to defense and operations, environmental concerns. Everything else the government does comes out of one quarter of the federal budget. So when they talk about cutting the federal budget, It's almost impossible to do unless you address that three-quarter number that is huge. We have failed. The war on poverty, we lost, and it's time to acknowledge that. It has taken people out of poverty. The situation in the world back in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s was vastly different than it is now. There have been effective programs in place, but we never take a look at them to see if it could be done better. They grow like kudzu on the highway. They just keep growing and growing and growing, and we never trim them, we never change them, we never do any program evaluation. If we want to address all these other kinds of issues, we better get a handle on federal spending.
Well, I'll come back to talk a little bit about entitlement spending later, but I wanted to sort of jump on or correct a point that you talked about, the idea that we don't have enough money to fix these environmental problems. That's really not the issue with moving to a clean energy economy, because we're already spending money. We talked about coal-fired power plants. There's also been an effort to build four new nuclear reactors. Duke Energy just canceled two of them. And in 2006, when they passed a very special law to allow for cost recovery for new nuclear power plants in advance of building the power plants, it used to be you couldn't charge someone until the plant came online, but they gave them this very special provision, and they started collecting money. And the plants at the time, they said they would be $5 or $6 billion, and now they're $25 billion, because again, they are the waiters in the restaurant, because they make four times as much money with a new nuclear power plant, although not one has been built in 30 years, and they're probably not going to happen in the state. In fact, Duke has canceled those. But the point is what it's about doing the most economic thing first. It's about doing conservation. It's about saving money. And when you put a solar panel up, and I know my friends here, Marty Monroe and John Rimes, are very happy solar owners. John may want to chime in about what a great payoff they have had in the solar. So people are financing in themselves. But then they have solar energy for free for many years. So it's not an economic. It is a complete myth to say that somehow clean energy costs more. It is not true.
Tell that to the people in West Virginia.
Randy.
Can I throw in something there?
West Virginia.
Because I think at least the way so far we've framed this climate change issue, it's especially the way both of you presented it initially, it's the believers in climate change and the non-believers. But I don't think that's quite right. I mean, I think there are a lot of people where the big issue is, what should we do about this looking ahead? In order to get a handle on that, let me start by looking back and let you think about this a little bit. Because all this addition of the carbon to the atmosphere is a result of the industrialization that goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Look at all the heads. Everybody says, yeah, that's absolutely right. So let me ask you people, I mean, now we've created this problem. How many of you would be willing to go back to the same standard of living people had in 1750 in exchange for removing that carbon out of the atmosphere? Back in 1750...
That's not your choice.
Back in 1750, 85% of the workforce was working in agriculture, because that's how many people it took. You know, it's the hand labor walking behind the plows. If you go back to 1900, look at the 20th century, the per capita income in the United States went up by seven times from 1900 to 2000. So if we just look at the carbon we've added to the atmosphere from 1900 to 2000, how many of you people would be willing to cut your income to one-seventh what it is today in order to not have that carbon in the atmosphere now?
Randy, so that's not a choice either.
So now let's look forward. If we're actually concerned about the well-being of people in the future, we need to make sure, as Ed was saying, we need to make sure that we maintain the economic growth so we can improve their welfare. Over the past century, our per capita income went up by seven times. If we keep economic growth going, per capita income can go up another seven times. So how do you think people in the future would be better off? If we keep our current standard of living and reduce global warming, or if the Earth warms by a couple of degrees and people have seven times as much income to deal with it. So now I'm not suggesting that Susan or Brian are talking about no economic growth. What I'm saying is we need to look very carefully at the costs that we're talking about when we're looking at climate change. And because of technological advances, it may be that the best thing to do is to wait on some of these things. Because technology advances, it could be cheaper in 10, 20, 30 years to address these problems than it is today.
Randy, and I guess I'd like to address that. You very skillfully changed the approach that Susan and I have, and that is...
Thank you.
I don't want to... Very skillfully. My hat's off to you. But I got to tell you, I'm not saying non-believers versus believers in climate change. I'm saying non-believers versus believers in 10,000 scientists, 98.4% of whom have studied the issue and said there is human-driven climate change and it has to be addressed fast. And another point I'm saying is some of those deniers or the skeptics in the beginning, I talked about one of them. There are a number of those skeptics that now have flipped and done their own analysis, and they've said, yes, it is happening. Yes, we must do it now. Yes, it is significant. Yes, it is an asteroid. There isn't one scientist that has flipped and gone the other way and said, well, I believe that there is human-driven climate change. I changed my mind. I'm a skeptic now. Not one. So I don't want to have, what I'd love to see is that at least we recognize the facts that the science is pretty much sealed, signed, and delivered. You know, especially when I know there's one skeptic left who continues to get depressed, and you've probably heard his name. It's Lindzen, and he's the same scientist. He is a physicist, but he's the same scientist who, for years and even to today, has not ever agreed that smoking will cause adverse impacts on the health. And he's the same fellow who's holdout for whether or not there's human-driven climate change. I'd take 98.4% of scientists over a fellow like that at this point, no hands down. And I would just like the public to know that. So the public doesn't have to make a decision, is there or isn't there. Let's listen to the folks who are the physicists, who are the real folks who have studied this, and let's make our decision based on that. But let's make sure. One of the big problems, just like the coal plant back years ago, I had a real problem, which was a spin. If you remember how many, here we were trying to get out facts, and we were dealing with multi-hundred-thousand-dollar budgets that were doing all over the newspapers and the radio and everywhere. Everything was, the coal plant is necessary now. The coal plant is going to be clean coal. No such thing as clean coal. This wasn't then, isn't now. Do we all know what happened when JEA was not able to build that coal plant years ago? And it's something that we said they would do. The people in Jacksonville had said, we don't want any more coal plants. We have two of them, not a third. That's why they came over here to begin with. It was out of sight, out of mind, so they built it, wanted to build it in Perry. And we said, hey, if those people in Jacksonville don't want it, we shouldn't bring it over in our backyard. Well, when it finally got shot down, they built a natural gas plant in Jacksonville in their backyard. They reduced their emissions by 50% because they're using natural gas, which is 50% less carbon dioxide. They reduced their rates. Do you remember how we heard we need the coal plant because rates are going to go up, rates are going to go up? What happened to your rates here in Tallahassee? And do our county commissioners get any credit for the fact that many of them did acknowledge that it was a mistake that they were going to coal?
I want to add to that, Brian.
The rates have come down here. They've gone down in Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a question here. To what extent do we have to all agree on either of these, the scope of either of these problems or even the causation of either of these problems, to agree on any steps that might be taken on either front? Susan talked about the people who turn to solar voluntarily, for example. They act to some extent on their belief and their sense of civic responsibility. To what extent can we also do that as a matter of policy
on
entitlements
mic
as well?
Okay, it works.
Okay.
Well, part of what happened...
Mic check at the bar.
Part of what happened in the coal battle, and my friend Steve Urs is back here,
who was that person
involved in this? The city of Tallahassee said they needed 210 megawatts going over the next 20 years. And they ended up in what you call an integrated resource planning. It's a utility planning process where you put supply and demand on a level playing field. And they found they could meet 165 megawatts of that 210 with energy efficiency. Energy efficiency and conservation is the cheapest stuff there is. Why on God's green earth, when you can get energy efficiency for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour, would you go build a coal plant or new nuclear plants that are, you know, 15 to 20 cents a kilowatt hour? So that's what the city did, and you all have a very, Gil Ziffer sitting here, others, you have a very successful energy efficiency program, and the city's utility has very high ratings, but that's what we need to do all over the state. And municipal electric companies like in Lakeland, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, Orlando, they operate with a different motive. And so I think this is where we need to come to terms with the politics of this.
I about fell off my chair during the 2012 Republican convention when Mitt Romney, in one of the debates, said, "I love coal." Well, I did events at both conventions, and let me tell you, the Republican convention was sponsored by the coal companies. And he said, it was almost reminded me of like a product placement. Does anyone remember the movie Wayne's World, where they made fun of product placement? So Mitt Romney actually stood up in a national debate and said, "I love coal." And all countries like, and I know you alluded to West Virginia, and I'm sorry about the people of West Virginia, but we cannot be buggy whip people. We do not go out and buy 8-track cassette decks. And if anyone in here has an iPhone, like many people do, and other, you know, wonderful telephones, think about that for a minute. Should we be stuck buying rotary phones just because people in West Virginia? There's going to be a whole new set of jobs that's going to come out of the clean energy economy.
Like Solyndra.
Neil, I just want to point out here that we've talked a lot about the coal plant and electricity generation in Florida and so forth, but if we're really concerned about climate change, there's not very much we can do at the state level. Florida produces very little in the way of greenhouse gases. The real problems are over in China. They're overseas in other areas. And in fact, if we raise the cost of energy in the United States, we push more production overseas to where they're even dirtier. Now, China's cleaner than the United States?
No, we're not going to raise the cost of energy. And here, let me just do the Solyndra thing because I don't get it. The reason Solyndra went out of business was because the price of solar went down. That's what happened. Their business model failed. And if you know how to get rid of sweetheart deals where campaign contributors get special deals, let's figure that out. That might be a whole other Village Square. But that's not what Solyndra was about. China flooded the market with solar and the price came down. That's what happened to Solyndra. And it's not about energy costing more.
Hey.
Yeah, that's great. If China will flood our market with lower cost solar panels, we don't need a public policy for that. Individuals themselves will choose the cheaper option. That's the way that we ought to approach it.
But we don't have competition. That's the problem.
But let's suppose, what if there were a state policy that said, as I think happened 3 or 4 years ago, we don't want any more coal plants in the state of Florida. And suppose that we have the situation that Brian described in which building the natural gas plant actually ended up being a cheaper alternative, I think, in terms of consumers, as he was describing it, than the one that was in mind, although it was a good, it was one reason, was diversification of sources and so on. Suppose it doesn't cost that much different. Suppose it's more efficient for everybody to build natural gas than for one homeowner after another to do solar. I mean, how do we think about this in terms of choice versus a general public policy? Let me look at Randy and then Ed.
If you're talking about the market for electricity, which we've talked about a lot, that's a regulated market where the government has given individual companies monopolies. So the problem there is largely a problem of government policy. When you give somebody a monopoly and you guarantee them a rate of return. The issue there isn't a problem with the market, it's a problem with government policy. But so often I think the problems we have are problems of government policy. And the problem there, I don't see how to get around it, is it's driven by politics, not by economics or good sense.
Hear, hear.
I totally agree.
So I guess we can leave.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're all
good to hear an agreement there. But
can I offer you a crown royal?
This brings us to the end of the delayed broadcast portion of the January 14th, 2014 To the Village Square Community Forum. To hear the remainder of the show, go online to www.tothevillagesquare.org. This program was recorded at St. John's Episcopal Church in Tallahassee. Join us again next time for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU-FM.